islands because a glacial age didn't reach that place. So our Neanderthal man is found in a certain island down there. And then Dr. Leakey found some more human remains in Africa. Well, when the continent sunk, the continent of Atlantis, then the Nile was occupied by the Egyptian. Just lately, with time immemorial, it's just lately they moved to Egypt, while there were our people, about 265 miles off the coast of Florida. You find in a triangle there a pyramid, a submarine pyramid, which is so-called magazine. What's the name of that magazine now that they pick on so much? It's one of those newspaper magazines that indicated that there was a submarine pyramid there, 6 feet higher than the pyramid of Cheops in Egypt. The only reason it's 6 feet higher is because there was 6 foot of loose gravel that was around the base of it when it was built, and it's on solid rock. So you see, it's nothing new for us to talk about Egyptian pyramids. We knew of them. We knew of outer space people also. We knew that they existed. One of our Indian doctors is Sukh, outer space people. And for a long time he prepared himself, and finally he went on a fast and started seeking the outer space people. And one day he was walking on a swamp and he heard some whispering. He's right down there. He's swimming around down there. So he gradually looked up and he saw this canoe halting over him about the height of these chandeliers overhead here. And they said, he's watching us. There's four people in that canoe. And the one in a bow had a javelin. And he said, I'll spear him. So as soon as he was ready to spear him, he ducked underneath a bullpine. And he swam under the kelps. Let's wait. So they waited. They had paddles. These are outer space people. And when they got through talking in there, he was listening to them, taking in what they were saying. And he's been after us for a long time. Let's kill him. So he came out. He figured being killed would be the deal where he could get them. So he came out and he showed himself to them. Here he is now. So the fellow in the bow speared him. As soon as that spear hit him, he didn't know anything. And for a long time, you know, you could tell how long you've been sleeping when you fall asleep. Soon he came to. He was sitting up against his bullpine, resting, and he was bleeding. And he said, well, the canoe is gone. I've lost them again. Just about that time, one of them started to talk inside of him. And the other one, the third one and the fourth one, they were all arguing, saying, see, it's your fault that we speared him. Now he's got us. So you see, we believe that outer space people at one time used to visit us quite often. But as time went on and this Earth's getting older and all the smog and everything, they can't stand the air that we breathe anymore. Just like we can't stand the depth if we dive into deep water and get the bends. So they can't stay around us too long. What I'm driving at is, by telling you this story and some of the other things that I know, is to prove that our people has been here a long time ago, and we had a good civilization until our white brothers came along. Then they start telling us, your civilization is for the birds. We don't want that. So they begin to educate us. And when they began to educate us, they didn't want us to speak our own language, the Tlingit language, Haida, Tsimshian, Kwakiutl, whatever. And when the time came for us to transized to their civilization, they didn't accept us. There was a little prejudice connected with it. And so they began to look down on us. I remember as a small boy in Sitka, when I go to the theater, I was told to sit on one side of the theater and the whites on the other. When we go to a restaurant, the same thing happened. We go to a nightclub, the door is shut on our face. One young couple got married in Sitka about 1911, 1910. And they were celebrating their wedding, and there was all kinds of rice on their clothes yet. So they went to the Moose Hall. The Moose Hall was in operation then. And the door manager saw that there were Indians and slammed the door right in their face, almost broke the young man's nose. So the elders got together in Sitka. You know, you've seen a picture of the Alaska Native Brotherhood organizers. They got together about 1911, and they began to discuss this situation. They said, there's to be no more of this, or we'll have an act of war if this keeps up. And one man says, instead of having war, why don't we organize an organization that's equal to theirs? Something that'll take care of our affairs. And therefore, the birth of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. 1912, the organization was finally organized. You know, most of you know the names of the organizers. I know the ones from Sitka, where I was raised. That was Ralph Young, Paul Liberty, and Peter Simpson from Sitka. And the rest from Angoon, it was Eli Katnook. And from Tlawak, James Johnson. Chester Worthington from Wrangell. I've missed some, but there's more. What happened was they got together. We used seine boats at that time. Anything we could get a hold of to get together for a convention. And it was decided to have the first convention. I believe it was Wrangell. And they were young people organized into an orchestra. My dad was one of the mandolinists. He was a mandolinist. And my uncle was a guitarist, and then there was another one that could play the bass fiddle, that was Paul Liberty. George Ross played the violin, and before you know it, they had a whole orchestra, and they began to order music from, I even remember the name of the company, Remick Music Company, and they were playing dance orchestra of that time, the Shottises, the Polkas, the one step, two step, three step, and the waltz. And that's how they raised money to build the first A and B hall in Sitka. When they went out to get the A and B hall lumber, they went out to Deep Inlet near Sitka in the wintertime, and there were falling trees big enough to be made into lumber, regular sawlogs, spruce. They'd fall them and it'd skid clear down into a deep inlet, and they wouldn't come up for a long time. Pretty soon it'd come up. And after they rafted it, they brought it to W.P. Mills' sawmill, and he cut them 50-50. He kept 50% of the lumber, and the Alaska Native Brotherhood got 50% of their half of the lumber. They bought nails, they raised, they used to have jitney dances in those days. They paid 10 cents a dance to take a round of dance. And if you dance 10 times, you spend a dollar. And then refreshments were served by the ladies. And each dance was carried on in a tribal house until the A and B hall was finished. It was rough lumber to begin with. And then they finally got some smooth siding. And it was a little small. Some years later, I was big enough then, we rebuilt the hall into a good-sized building, the A&B Hall that you see now in Sitka. The little hall is still in there. The new one was an addition to it. So it went. All the other communities, if I remember, struggled with their halls, and they built them up. The reason I'm telling you these things is we had a hard row to hoe in order to be recognized by the white man. And when they realized we were doing our own political game, they began to respect us. I remember William Paul went to Jonah one time to fight some issues. And there was a lawyer there by the name of Grover Wynn. And after the court, they came out on a street and Grover Wynn challenged him to a fight. And William Paul happened to be a good athlete at the time. He was just out of Carlisle and he was a wrestler, a professional wrestler and a football player. So William says, okay. He took his coat off and so did Grover Wynn. Before the fight was over, Grover decided to call it quits and he had to go to the hospital to get untied. So you see, our people did hoe a rough road to get where we are now. You take this building here. This building was paid for by very few people. It was donated. The foundation cost them around $20,000, and then the rest of the building on top cost quite a bit too. And it was all from one family, this money was donated. So you see, our people have their own way. They are independent. The only thing we don't have now are doctors and nurses. And whenever we get our own doctors and nurses, then we can tell them to do what they want to with Mount Edgecombe Hospital and a hospital in Anchorage. But until then, we've got to have a hand to withstand our medical expenses. Like the Russians made the United States promise, whenever they get on their feet and they're equal with you, then you can let them go as citizens. We became citizens in 1922. And ever since that time, we've had a rough road to hoe again. Because after we began to mix with the whites in the restaurants, in the movies, in the churches, there was something else they picked a bone about, that we weren't clean enough. Things like that come up. Some people smell, and I know some whites I've smelled that I wouldn't live with either. But you know, those things do occur in all races, and we must be careful what we say about those things. Since you've asked me to testify, I'm exposing these things to you so that you know. Now, there's land here that we want to protect. Here in the Chilkat area, the Chilkoot area, the Admiralty Island, Sitka area. Those pulp mills that our white brothers brought over here take 2 long rafts a day. They got a big appetite. I don't know how many million feet of board feet there is in a raft, but I know that it takes 2 tugboats sometimes to tow them to the pulp mill. And they take those 2 rafts a day when they're running full bore. Now I understand they haven't paid any stumpage to the government. They haven't paid their income tax return and therefore they slowed them down. Some of them are beginning to cut lumber for commercial purposes. And another thing that happened is they brought up these people, these poor people from Alabama and all the southern states, clear up to Oklahoma, and put them in these pulp mills. Well, they landed them in Sitka and Ketchikan area. They had nothing to live in. The rent was too high for them. So they went to work in Sitka and built them these cracker boxes, you know, these buildings. That's a very simple building. Some of them won't last over 70 years, I don't think, because they're very poorly built and very poorly insulated. And they want $200,000 a piece for those buildings. So when the pulp mill worker is paid, a portion of his wages goes on the payment of that building. And it'll take them a lifetime to pay for it. So therefore, these same people fall back on our natural resources. They are allowed 20 to 30 deer per family right there in Sitka. This is why I moved over to Haines, because Sitka was getting too crowded for me. Same way with Ketchikan. They have a mill there that's very precarious about its operation. I helped build the Ketchikan mill from start to finish, so I know what I'm talking about. And moreover, they ship all the products to Japan. I've known some of it to go to some other nations as well. And they fill these pulp ships so much. One of them sunk at the Sitka dock, something happened to it. And when the pulp began to expand, the ship burst in half. So you see, they're not very careful about what they do with the natural resources. By the time they pay for the damage they have done in impurities of the air and the acids that go into the air and the water, the, what do you call that, some syrup-like stuff they put into the bay, they finally had to purify that before they put it in. Red liquor, they call it, and it contains a lot of chemicals. Most of the trees around the Sitka pulp mill are dead. Some of the trees around the Ketchikan pulp mill are dying also. And the workers are getting lung cancer and all that from the pulp. You can get it from asbestos too, but you can get it also from pulp and the chemicals they use. So you see, they're wasting our products. When the Russians used to ship their sea otter to Russia, it took 1 year to get it to Moscow. So when they killed the sea otters with the Aleut help, they would skin them with a little fat on the skin to preserve them, and then they'd rock salt them. They rock salt barrels of it and then send it to Russia. When the Volga River is frozen, they can take horses and sled and go clear to Moscow with it in the wintertime. And then in spring and summer, when the Volga is thawed out, they float rafts down with supplies to come back to Alaska to do some more fur buying. But over half of the furs that they took over there salted, spoiled by the time it got to Moscow, and our sea otter was wasted. There was nothing but the skin left, the hair all fell off. This is a known fact. And now we're trying to revive the sea otters too. There's a lot of things that's out of order yet. The pulp mill, the pulp they take, the trees they take for pulp mill and lumber, they can't reforestate. So for instance, Hunau Sound. It took millions of years for that topsoil to get on those mountains. And when you log it off and don't leave any bushes, you don't leave any alders, and you clean cut the whole thing, take everything out, and then attempt to reforestate it. You can reforestate it all right, but the next season, the equinox storm comes along, it washes out all the trees, all the little trees. A place like Long Island, where there are heavy valleys, and they're leaving some timber standing, that protects the soil. And they won't rebuild the roads on Long Island for the simple reason that it's private property. Now this is another point I want to bring out. Anything that belongs to the Indians, like the Haidas and the Tlinkets, they won't punch a road through you unless you give them some timber for it. And I think that's it's a bad deal for us. I feel that we should get coin for coin. Whatever they take out, they should pay for. And when we say stop taking it out, it should stop because we have a good reason. And this is what's happening now. We're beginning to hold back on our timber, on our minerals. Tlakuan is sitting on some iron up there that they can't have yet. So the government says anything under the ground is not yours. You own the land, yes. You can live on it, but anything like gold and coal and iron is not yours. We can take it at will. And I beg to differ with them because this is our land. And if we're living on it and we use it, we have a big say with it. And I think government of the United States will sooner or later realize that we mean business, that we're not to be kicked around anymore. It's been enough of that. We are now at a point where we have to fight back. We are at a point now where they have to learn to respect our opinion. We are at a point now where we have to work together instead of tribes. Tribal differences and family differences is one of the biggest weapons they have against us. When an Indian gets up to where he is recognized by the world, the rest of the tribes pull him down. And that's our nature, and they take advantage of that. But we are learning how to play ball now. We are learning how to work together. And this next convention that they're absent for now will tell whether they will make it or not in the next 2 years. I feel that we've come to a point where we can fight politically, fight with lawsuits, and fight the way you fought before, hand-to-hand fighting. That can happen yet. And all these Indians of the United States are related to us. We're all relatives. And the Negro that you brought over from Africa are also our friends. They were brought over here against their will, and they've been oppressed. As long as I could remember, a Negro hasn't been accepted in public until just lately. They're beginning to take their hats off to them, because when you oppress a nation so long, then they become good at athletics, they become good at being a lawyer, and all the other professions begin to flower out. Booker T. Washington built an institution of his own, which shows that the Negro is advancing also. Abraham Lincoln foresaw these things, and he fought for them. He even gave his life for them. How many of us would give our life for people that don't even concern us? I don't know. I know I wouldn't. But the time is coming when we'll have to think like Abraham Lincoln did. And if Abraham Lincoln was alive, and if George Washington was alive, and William Booth, one of our religious leaders, was alive in his country right now, he would have something to say about this too. They would all have something to discuss about it. I think I've taken enough time from you now, and if you ask me any more questions, I'll answer them. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Thank you very much.
My name is Peter Johnson. I'm a Tlingit Indian from the Hoonah area and moved here to Haines about 25 years ago. I'm one of the few Indians who is remarkably ignorant of the Land Claims Act. There are some things happening that I don't really like. One of them is the subsistence. Every time they meet and talk about that, they are talking about taking it away from the Indians. And I feel very strongly that it shouldn't be. Another is the health and welfare of the Indians. On my job, I work for the state of Alaska at the Alaska Marine Highway, and I do have, pardon?
You said you worked for the Alaska Native?
I work for the state of Alaska with the Alaska Marine Highway System.
Oh, Marine Highway, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Um,
I do have insurance to cover my needs, but I believe there are a lot of Indians that do not have the coverage. And I would like to see that cover maintained for each one of the Indians in Alaska. I was reading an article written by William Paul, and he was talking to the leaders in each one of the
regions.
Yeah, each one of the regions. And I agree with what William Paul has to say. I know there's been a lot of write-ups on the Land Claim Act, but I haven't really talked to anybody that knows very much about it. And I would like to see more publicity on that. It's something that is going to affect the lives of every Indian in Alaska, Eskimo and Aleut. And it's important enough, I think, that when they get together and talk about that, I think it's just as important to hear what they have to say for us, as well as against it. And I think it's just like the politicians that are running for public office. And I think we should hear it more over the either radio or television, so we'll know what our leaders are doing for us. Within the smaller communities, like this one here, I've been pretty well ignorant of most of the outside news. I get a newspaper once in a while. I manage to listen to the radio once in a while, and I am pretty ignorant of that Land Claims Act. But I am here to testify because I know it's going to affect my life and the lives of my family, my children. And those two areas that I was talking about is the ones that I'm really concerned about. And I think if it was publicized more, people would become more aware of the Indians in the valley. The Indians themselves would become more interested in what is happening. And that interest might turn into an active interest. And we do need an active interest by everyone. And I guess that's about all that I would have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, sir.
Again, my name is Tom Jimmy. I was been sitting there just wondering how long it was going to take me to prepare myself, and maybe that's not something I'll ever be, so, you know, sometimes we wait too long and the opportunity just passes. And so I wanted to make an attempt to express what I feel the effects of the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act has been on my life. And I was thinking in terms of subsistence. And there were a couple of people that came up here and gave their testimonies that talked about our traditions and our customs, our stories. And I started thinking about a lot of the time that I spent with my grandfather, Austin, and where he's concerned, I'm particularly biased. I respect him and I love him a lot for all the knowledge that he has, and I really appreciate the things that he really tries to teach us. That wasn't always so. I, a long time ago, rebelled against a lot of these things and felt like there was a lot of responsibility that was being put, and I didn't feel like I was qualified to be able to live up to that responsibility. And so I went out and involved myself in the ways of the world, and but that experience has taught me a lot. I've had a lot of people that have had a lot of confidence in me and place that confidence in me by placing responsibility on me, which gave me a lot of opportunities to travel, to visit with different people, and see the concerns that they were dealing with. Not quite sure how to word this, but I was thinking in terms of the stories that have been told to me and our subsistence way of life. After I had left and moved down to the States, well, being away from home in general and just separated from a subsistence style of life. You know, I never really had taken the time to try to understand the association that was there. But when I went down and I was staying in Seattle and I really seriously began considering the association, I started realizing a lot of the things that Austin was trying to teach. I started remembering the different stories that he was telling and how that applied to my life. And then the more that I began reflecting on these things, the more important that they became to me. Of course, a lot of the other experiences that I just mentioned earlier in traveling, a lot of those things really had a lot to do with these reflections. But it's really difficult when to understand the stories and just exactly what it is he's trying to put across without having the subsistence experience. Because when I really began to put these things together, as I tried searching for all kinds of different answers. I went into and studied law on myself. I studied psychology. And these were just readings that I just took the time to do myself. And it seemed more and more that I read these different forms of literature, the more I realized that they were pointing towards home. And so I came back to Haines. I started asking questions. I started really listening to the kind of things that our elders had to pass on to us. And I started spending more time in our subsistence lifestyle. I started seeing the kind of character and personality development that was acquired through this lifestyle. And I started appreciating more the value of these stories. And so now I'm back here at home, and I try to spend as much time with my grandfather Austin as I can. And I really feel that our people, we're so occupied fighting for our rights that we don't have time to really try to understand our heritage. And that was one of the reasons why I brought out the analogy of the interviews that I had with these refugees from Cambodia. Whether or not that was a strategy that was that possibly the American government had in mind in the first place, I can't say. All I can see is looking at it from a foresight. And so when I sit and listen to the circumstances that we find ourselves in right now, I find it really difficult to offer any kind of testimony when I don't have the insight or the understanding of just what the repercussions will be from these hearings. I hope, for one, that somehow we'll be able to spend more time, not necessarily trying to even in a corporate sense, to conform to the corporate structure as it is, or as the American government uses it, but trying to think instead of how we can reflect our own history. Because I think it was all a part of our people's culture in a lot of ways. It was just done differently. I find myself sitting here right now thinking that there's so much more that can be said. There's so many other things to consider. But it's hard to just try to pull them out of the air, realizing that how important what we're doing here is, and just what the effects of this is going to be to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jimmy. Well, we had 12 people spoke last night in Clutquan, and 12 people have spoken today here in Haines. It's equal time for both places, I guess. But it's been very useful today, and I'm glad we decided to carry on this afternoon so that we could hear from Mr. Lewis and Mr. Johnson and from Sfoldy and from Mr. Jimmy again. Well, I've had a few questions last night and today, but not very many. I'm really interested in what people here think is vital, and it is part of the whole picture that I'm seeing around the state.
Now, and it could be written. Anglicitis, Sinciens, and the Athapascan, Eskimo, Aleut, the same alphabet. And I'm just wondering what's going to happen to our oral history, our oral stamina that we've created the last few thousand years. What's going to happen to it? Is it going to be shot down or divided up in books and therefore trampled underfoot? If there's no need for oral remembrance?
Well, I'd like to, I'd like to get what you're saying down on the tape. Could you pass the, that, sorry, Mr. Lewis, but we've just enlisted Tony to, maybe you could just repeat those thoughts, Mr. Lewis.
I won't shoot you.
No. What I'm saying is there's a big transition coming on. Just the last few years we've been able to write our language. And a lot of our people are writing stories already. That's not founded well into the knowledge of the elders. A lot of them are creating fiction along with the true stories, the legends, and our history is getting twisted also. A lot of things is changing position. Now our brother here, Hein Miller, he's got Indian dances that he created himself, tunes that's patterned after our meters and everything, but no words. And he has created something that would have happened to our dances and song anyway. And he's been clever enough to hit it right on the nose. Now, what will happen to the rest of our culture as it's being washed out? You take the timber and take them out of the forest. All this topsoil that's been there for millions of years is going to wash down into the bay. Who's going to replace it? Who's going to replace the culture we're losing? Who's going to replace the hard times that taught us things? Now our young people go to school, to a highly compressed school, where the curriculum is so tight they can't even listen to us when they come home. Oh, you're just some old person, you're my grandpa, yes, but I'm learning what's good in school, so they won't listen to me anymore. I'm quite sure that Mr. Johnson and Mr. Hammond and the rest of us here are experiencing that same situation, only in different degrees. Some of that's here now can't even understand the language. And when we get down to brass tacks and really discuss it for sure, that's where our problem lies, where this big change is taking place. You don't see anybody interested in these meetings now because they think they know it all. They went to a college, they went to a high school, a grade school, where a white man has brainwashed them. There was a time I couldn't speak my own language without somebody putting a tape on my mouth and making me stand up into a corner or making me kneel down on beams, you know, to get rid of the language that fast. And then some missionaries came along and took our dancing regalia, and they told us, if you dance with knives and be warlike all the time, how is this good civilization going to affect you? Are you going to learn anything from us? You must get rid of that idea of war. You must get rid of the idea of dancing and bringing back the traditional spirits that you are among you. Well, the same spirits exist among our white people too, among the white people. They call it ghosts, sometimes they call it witchcraft. You can name it. The power of Satan, satanic people that worship Satan himself. We never had to do that. But now some of our people are beginning to penetrate those things. And they're beginning to use marijuana and dope and all the other things besides liquor. When I was drinking, I drank liquor, yes, but beer and stuff like that. I never had to take dope. No, nicotine was bad. I had to quit it, and I quit it. So you see, our people are still getting brainwashed. They're getting brainwashed faster because they're on a downhill pull with us now. And the only thing we can do is look to our Heavenly Father for help. That's where I get my help. A lot of the others do too. And we go to the Bible and we search for the truth. In many places it says, mentally bound by the white man can get free if we look into the right place. And I believe that the day is coming when a lot of our people will stand on their own feet. Now my nephew Tommy Jimmy says, I don't have much knowledge in that line, so therefore I'm just going to tum-tum around and make a lot of noise overboard. That's not true either. If you feel inferior, you're inferior. If you feel you can stand up to a white man, you can. With what little knowledge you have. Some of them don't have any knowledge at all. Now, I went to a meeting last night where the leader called our functions of land and all that, talking about that philosophy. Well, I happen to know that philosophy is all wit. They call God the main power of our universe, the underlying cause. So when I studied philosophy in Sheldon Jackson, I failed. I got a zero, because everything I said turned into theology, which is the same thing with God in it. My professor says, George, I can't give you any credit. And he was a Christian. He says, I'll give you credit in theology instead. So I got credit for theology for studying philosophy. So when our leaders tell us, you must write in a philosophical way, this leader was telling us last night, you must portray it philosophically. What is it with God left out? That's what it is. Socrates mentioned God, there must be a supreme power, and they poisoned him with hemlock. So we know that the two things are different. And I also mentioned to them St. Paul, when he was first struck down by the light, going to Damascus to get Christians to have them killed and be used for Roman candles on a street so Nero could walk and see his way. Paul was struck down by that light. And the reason Christ went after Paul was he was a Roman citizen, but he was a Jew. We're in Indians of Alaska, but we have something to tackle. So God will find a way for us to tackle it by becoming citizens. We've been citizens, I mentioned, since 1922. And I believe we've got a good foothold now. Now, when first William Paul tried for the land suit business, all these lawyers were told there's no law that can compel the United States government to pay you monies, unless there's a law to represent your rights. There must be a law enacted first in Congress that will give you the right to sue us. So they worked on that for about 15 years more. I remember when my dad put out money, when my toes were showing, my shoes already, he put out his last $20 so William Paul could go to Washington, D.C. And some people tell me now that William Paul was all wet too. But do you know, he and a few other lawyers got that law enacted. And therefore we could have a clear road to sue the United States government. Now more Indians caught on to it up westward, which you now we call AFFN. And the one that was the leader, that was holding these people's hands and leading them on like a child, is the Alaska Native Brotherhood. The Alaska Native Brotherhood is the father of all these organizations, including Sea Alaska. They got power, they got money in the millions. They're losing millions on account of the lack of experience. But like Tommy says, I'm all wet. I don't know enough yet. Well, that's what they're trying to do. They're learning. And in order to learn, you must lose millions of dollars. But the time is coming when we'll know better. And then, of course, some other disease is going to hit us, like pocketing some of that money. You know, that's always done after people get so highly educated, they begin to take money from that don't belong to them. Things like this I've been thinking about. Sometimes I can't sleep at nights thinking about it. But we're on an upward grade too, we're climbing. Since we are Roman citizens, now we can fight as Romans, although we're a Jew. You see what I mean? God picked men from time to time. Joshua was supposed to be a leader. God asked him to be a leader in place of Moses. And he says, no, Father, I don't think I can do that. I can't even take a step toward it because I'm crippled that way. And God told him, Joshua, you take the first step, I will help you with a second. Now this is how my thoughts are working this morning. We look to our Heavenly Father for what we want to say at this commission's meeting. And I think he'll feed us with the words to say it in coincidence with what we already have as problems. Sometimes we don't know how to word these things. Sometimes we get mad and uncontrollable when we think about it. But there is a Supreme Being that gives us these words. And there's a Supreme Being to guide your mind to and every other government leader. There's a Supreme Being that's going to control the next president or the same president. I believe so. If we all try and do the right thing, I could talk all night and still not say anything. But I'm trying to cover something I didn't say while I was up there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Could I just ask you a question? You mentioned the oral tradition and the fact that many legends and stories and history of the Tlingit people is being reduced to writing now. And you said, what's to become of oral remembrance? You felt that in translating these stories from the Tlingit language so as to be written down, something was being lost in the process. Anything else you'd like to say about that? You were talking about that before we put the mic on, and that's why I returned to it.
There's children's stories that we've been asked to write, Tlingit stories, you know, for children. They're already in oral form. the songs, the pet songs and everything is already sung. And in fact, it's all forgotten. I know some pet songs, but not very many. But each child, as they grow up, they're sung to and they're petted with these facts and songs. And the elders tell these stories, and when the young person leaves, while the elder is telling the story, he'll reach for his cane and lift it up and say, that one won't live very long. And sure enough, if they don't listen to their elders, they don't live long. There must be something to it. What I'm saying is this great transition that's going to occur, or in fact it's already occurring, will leave those with oral knowledge to keep their mouths closed. Because any old timer that knows these things won't tell the younger ones to write. If they do, they got to pay for it. The person that has all this knowledge reserved feels they have a living coming from it. This is one of the maladies that's occurring now. People will die with stories and facts and philosophy, if you want to call it philosophy. And then the words of God, they all die with them because nobody will partake of it. They can stand on the streets and shout at the top of their voices, nobody will listen. This is what's happening. And I feel that our people for one nation will fail if we don't revive it. In other words, we're trying to revive our culture. Now, I volunteered to give some lectures to some young Salvation Army officers that's coming up here next year. I want them to know the traditions of our people, the culture, so that they can administer to our people through the right channels. If they don't know these facts, there's some places we agree with the white folks. There's some places we agree with Christianity. But there are some places that becomes an interference. And when you come up against an interference as a professional preacher or a teacher or a lawyer, you cannot penetrate that person's mind unless you overcome that obstruction that's there. And it's on account of the Indian training that we have had in time past. You take a Japanese child and start teaching him English, he has more of an obstruction. There's not even any place where it's harmonized. So this proves, for one, that we don't come from Mongolia. Their language is so complicated, like ours. But we have proven from the what's the name of those languages now? Sanskrit languages, that the Tlingit language will stand up as being older than the Chinese language even. And we know we've used ideographic writing. We've made our wills on parchment like the Egyptians did and the Chinese. You draw a house and you draw a canoe, you draw a boat, whatever belongs to your uncle. And then you give it to the nephew. By the time the uncle dies, the nephew's got the will. Maybe two wives and four or five slaves. Some blankets. Personal property is marked on those parchments by actual pictures. And that's what you call ideographic writing, which the Chinese used. Mm-hmm. So nowadays we don't even make a will. When we make a will, our kids fight over it anyway, you know. We're way off the track. We're learning something, though. That's where I'm a big to the difference. If we go into writing, there's a few from each family that's going to take advantage of it. And the ones that really know the facts are not going to get to write it because they won't bother writing it when it's being spoiled. See, our people are funny that way. You got to write your own history, your own family tree and all that before it's accepted. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Yes, Mr. Johnson.
While I was sitting there listening, I thought of a One other comment I would like to make. Even though I don't know too much about the land bill, if our leaders get to hear what we have to say, I would like to encourage them to speak out boldly on our behalf. As they're up there in a position of leadership, and as our leaders, they should be speaking out for something that they think is right. And about the only way I can really emphasize it is during the time I was in the Army, I made a few little waves by interpreting a regulation that told me that as an outsider, I should be getting overseas pay in the lower 48. And I went to see my finance officer and I talked to him about it, and the waves got all the way over to Department of the Army before I finally received an answer on that particular regulation. And that's the way I think our leaders should be also. If they feel they're fighting for a real good cause, then by golly, they should be letting everybody know about it by any means possible, television, radio, what have you. And next week I'm going down to Juneau and I'm going to find out about that land bill, because I got a little vacation coming. But that's all I wanted to say, and I thank you once again.
Thank you, sir. Well, I want to thank all you folks for coming this afternoon, and as I said about the testimony given this morning, it's been helpful to me, and each place I go adds something to the whole picture, and I'll complete my travels early in the new year, and my report will be sent to you in the summer of 1985, and then you can judge for yourselves how well I've done, but I do hope it will help Alaska Natives to decide where they're going and how they're going to get there. And certainly I intend, as I said last night, to give advice to Native people in other countries and their governments. So thanks again, and I think I said we heard from 12 people in Clukwan and 12 people in Haines, and that's a good cross-section, I think, of the way people are looking at ANCSA and at the future here. So thank you all very much. Oh, I enjoyed it. Yep, that's right. Well, that's why I've got Jim here to take it all down. Well, thanks, Ed, for helping to organize the meetings.
Thank you. I'm certain we'll keep you in the prayer.
Okay, thank you. Yes, it is. Well, you don't forget me.